ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
From the moment the news broke on Friday afternoon, frankly, my phone blew up. I could say there were some people that said that they don't quite understand the move. It's an awful lot to give up. There are some people who said the Browns were bold to go get this guy. There are some people who say, don't they know about the discipline that's still out there, the 22 civil lawsuits and the potential suspension that he faces from the NFL? And all this is true, and you can say all that you want. But the fact of the matter is, there was a team out there that wanted Deshaun Watson badly enough that it was willing to give the richest guarantee the NFL has ever handed out.
We have never seen a partnership like the one just established between the Cleveland Browns and Deshaun Watson. Because on one end, you have an NFL team unapologetically thirsting for its first Super Bowl and a star quarterback. And on the other, you have the star quarterback, a 26-year-old who has avoided criminal charges but is currently being sued by 22 different women in civil court for sexual misconduct. So today, as the Browns break the bank for Watson, breaking financial records in the process, Mina Kimes explains what's really going on in Cleveland and across this unprecedented NFL offseason. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, March 21st. This is ESPN Daily. So, Mina, humanity has like a goldfish memory, and so much has happened in the story of Deshaun Watson that I think is really important to walk through with you here on this show. But I just want to start with Friday afternoon in specific, because that's when we learned that the Cleveland Browns were trading three first-round draft picks and a third-round pick and a fourth-round pick to the Houston Texans in exchange for Watson and a fifth-rounder. And so my first question here is simple. Were you surprised?
Yes, I was. I would say on a number of levels. I think first and foremost, the fact that it was Cleveland after it was reported they were out of the running, the horse race really, for Deshaun Watson. And it seemed at that point, until the very last minute, that it came down to Carolina, then they were knocked out, and then really New Orleans and Atlanta.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, news breaks that Cleveland has not only, re-entered the competition. Feels weird to call it a competition, but that's essentially what it was. But did so in a way where, they gave him the most guaranteed money in NFL history. Signed him reportedly to a, 5-year, $230 million deal. Sometimes I should say, these deals, we never know really what the actual money is, but I think the fact that the guarantees were significant is meaningful. And I think what's also meaningful, and it's been reported by a couple of places, that the way they structured the deal was to give him a base salary of just $1 million in 2022, which basically means that if Deshaun Watson is suspended, and I think this deal, the structure suggests that they are anticipating that likelihood, given that he's still facing, 22 civil lawsuits, they've minimized his financial punishment. It's pretty blatant what happened here. And I think just to kind of put a bow on it, so ultimately the shock is not just that it's Cleveland or that it's so much money, but what appears to have happened is that despite all of these allegations, the details which we're going to discuss, potential suspension, backlash from a fan base, all of it, Deshaun Watson sat out for a year and his leverage seems to have only increased.
Right. I mean, Mina, the athlete at the center of nearly two dozen active lawsuits actually gained power and leverage over an NFL team. And the way the very clever but also incredibly unsubtle accounting works here is that Watson gets this $45 million signing bonus upfront. That is guaranteed. With that strategically shrunken $1 million salary in year one, in case he is not allowed to play.
Yeah.
And then he gets $46 million a year over each of the next four seasons, all of it adding up to, yes, the most guaranteed money that the NFL has ever seen. But remind us why the Browns are so obviously preparing for a punishment. What has Deshaun Watson been accused of in the first place?
This is a story that's been going on now for over a year. And I would actually say It begins before the first allegation from Ashley Solis. It really begins when Deshaun Watson made it clear that he wanted out of Houston. That's the backdrop, right, of this whole case and ultimately how we got to this moment. And, you know, something kind of simmering for a while after the Texans traded away DeAndre Hopkins. A lot of criticism of the organization. I mean, I criticized the organization for a lot of decisions they made. And in the beginning of 2021, you know, news came out that he wanted out. Then a few months later, Ashley Solis, who's a massage therapist in Texas, comes out and sues Watson. And in the initial lawsuit, you know, accuses him of basically sexual misconduct during a routine session. After that, more and more people come forward. Ultimately, they do come forward with their names, by the way, with allegations ranging from sexual misconduct to, you know, indecent exposure to, in some cases, sexual assault. So this mounts over the course of several months. Deshaun Watson is not put on the commissioner's exempt list. So there's this awkward situation where last season he was just kind of around, you know, getting paid. And but the NFL's reasoning was that they wanted the criminal case to wrap. I guess their logic kind of escapes me on some level. But yeah, all this happens and the cases move forward. And then we get to a couple Fridays ago when ultimately the criminal complaints, and there's 10 of them, are heard by a grand jury.
And what have Deshaun Watson and his camp said in response to all of these allegations?
Yeah, so from the beginning, they denied the allegations pretty vociferously. His lawyer, Rusty Hardin, did say in, you know, some of his responses that Watson had had some consensual sexual encounters. As counter evidence, they pointed to the fact that some of the massage therapists continued, the ones who had, pardon me, you know, accused him of things, continued to work with him, which is, I should note, not entirely uncommon with cases like this or cases involving either sexual assault, domestic partner violence, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they also brought forward sort of testimonials from many more women who had worked with him during this period in the pandemic, actually ultimately bringing the number of therapists that he had worked with to over 40, well over 40, which, you know, is I think another thing that kind of struck people as being unusual, just the fact that such a, you know, prominent NFL player, a very highly compensated NFL player, was basically setting all of these appointments up with so many women informally on his own.
So we have this star quarterback who hired over 40 different massage therapists, which seems to be unusual, all of which resulted, as of today, in 22 civil lawsuits that are still active. And Rusty Hardin, Watson's attorney that you just alluded to, he notably referred to these lawsuits as a quote-unquote money grab in order to defend his client. And I guess it's worth asking here, Mina, are there massage therapists who worked with Watson who've come forward to accuse him of misconduct who did not decide to file a lawsuit in that way?
Yeah, that's an important question, just given, you know, that is does seem to be the core of their defense. So I mentioned that there were 10 criminal complaints, again, ultimately that did not result in an indictment. A couple of those accusers did not file civil lawsuit. So they just went straight to the criminal side of things. Another story that came out during this period was one by Jenny Vrentas, who was at Sports Illustrated at the time, now at the New York Times. She interviewed a veteran massage therapist. She called her Mary as a pseudonym. The woman was anonymous, who worked with Deshaun Watson in 2019 and was told Jenny that she was made uncomfortable because he exposed himself to her. She claimed that he was kind of thrusting into the air, basically just acting very sexually, candidly. And Jenny not only talked to her, but also talked to people that Mary had spoken with in 2019 and reviewed a text message that the therapist who initially got Mary this job sent to her afterwards, again, back in 2019, when Mary complained, saying, you know, whether this creepy stuff is intentional or not, he does it every time. Only one therapist hasn't complained. Note, again, Mary was not one of Tony Busby's clients, and per Jenny, ultimately decided not to sue at all.
So as all of this reporting is coming out, and a lot of this has sort of gotten lost in the sands of time over the last week, it's important to remember that, yeah, Deshaun Watson did not play quarterback for the Houston Texans for all last season.
Yeah.
And then the story gains all of this momentum. The trade talks gets into overdrive because what happened last Friday?
Yeah, so the district attorney's office in Harris County, Texas, presented evidence to a grand jury relating to the criminal complaints, I believe 9 of the 10 of them. So, you know, these, when grand juries review this evidence, it's hard for the outside world to know much about it because it's private. We don't know what they've seen. We don't know what evidence was put forward. We do know that they saw video interviews with the complainants. The New York Times reported that only one of the women was asked to speak to them, even though several of the women were there. But yeah, we just don't really know much more beyond that. And of course, these cases can be difficult to prosecute because there often is very little evidence. We're talking about massage sessions that were not taped, you know, but we do know that they decided not to move forward with a criminal case. And it seems very obvious that NFL teams, knowing that he wasn't facing imminent jail time, saw that as a green light to aggressively pursue a trade, despite the fact that there were still 22 civil suits outstanding.
And the parsing of the vocabulary here around the lack of jail time does feel critical, Mina, because none of this means, for the record, that Deshaun Watson has been exonerated or declared not guilty of anything. It simply means that the grand jury did not think that prosecutors had shown probable cause to support those specific criminal charges. And likewise, by the way, it's also important to note, in fairness to Watson, that there is no burden of proof to meet for someone to file a civil lawsuit. These are accusations. And so these complicated factors all enter into the calculus that the NFL has to make here. And I'm curious how you see that decision to suspend Deshaun Watson or not. Do you think that's likely at this point?
Well, all we can do is kind of look to precedent, right? I think the case that's gotten brought up a lot is Ben Roethlisberger, who was, you know, accused of rape many years ago, was not criminally charged, but was suspended. More recently, Ezekiel Elliott was accused of domestic violence. Again, not criminally charged. The NFL suspended him for 6 games. I think, frankly, the Cleveland Browns contract, the way they structured it, suggests that they are anticipating a meaningful suspension. But again, you know, it's hard to know exactly what that will look like without knowing what the NFL has found in their investigation. I should also note here that some of the women who were interviewed by the NFL said that the line of questioning in the investigation, in their interviews with the league, made them feel uncomfortable. They were asked what they were wearing. It was a different tone from their interviews with the police. So I say that not to say that, you know, it means there won't be a suspension, but it does feel like important context as we anticipate the next major moment in this saga.
Right. We await now the results of the NFL's own investigation. We await now the results of the 22 ongoing civil lawsuits, depositions for a majority of which reportedly have yet to even happen. Mm-hmm. And so it seems, by the way, that the Browns have made this huge decision, structured this contract in this extreme way, and they don't actually know concretely when their quarterback will be available for them to play.
Yeah, and it's also hard to know, by the way, like what the contract and the way it's structured, whether they're protected in any way from, you know, very long suspension, mm-hmm. like if it lasted more than a season, what sort of guarantees might be voided or not voided. All of that is up in the air, which is, by the way, not unusual with NFL contracts. Like, the sticker price is not usually what it is, right? All we know is, as I mentioned, they structured the deal to minimize his punishment, or his financial pain, rather, in the first season, which is very unusual. I mean, you'll hear that this, you know, teams do this with the way they structure their contracts to give players lower salaries and have signing bonuses, whatever. But again, like given the nature of what he is facing, what he continues to face, I think it's pretty clear what the contract means.
Yeah, I remember the last time I could recall a headline about a restructured contract in this way designed to minimize the pain of a suspension financially was with Tom Brady and Deflategate. Mm-hmm. This, though, is an entirely different genre. And, like, I wonder about the court of public opinion here, because the NFL on this seemingly has, due to its business, which is staggeringly successful, they seem to have an immunity to that in ways that other sports don't. But I'm curious how you think fans will react to this sort of a deal for this specific player and whether any of it even matters.
Well, I think given the fact, I keep going back to the Browns' behavior, that they announced the trade on a Friday and then waited until Sunday to put out a statement on it, which we can discuss. They were anticipating some backlash. And Pablo, I've seen a lot of that backlash. I've seen prominent Browns fans and bloggers and people in, you know, the fan community who are pretty apoplectic about this and the sort of moral conundrum they find themselves in. I've seen other fan bases express relief that they're not facing the situation. Again, all despite the fact that Deshaun Watson, when he is at his best, is a top five quarterback in the NFL.
Yes.
So I say that, but I have to temper it with the fact that, you know, we have seen over time that athletes like Ben Roethlisberger, accused of sexual violence, assault, what have you, the way that they're covered changes over time. Some people move on. Some fans move on. Certainly some analysts and announcers move on and are reluctant to remind people of what happened. Mm. But also say this, there are a lot of fans with Roethlisberger and some other athletes who don't ever move on. And I think that will probably be the case with Cleveland.
So what the Browns did say on their part via those statements you just described yesterday, I mean, they had a statement from the head coach, Kevin Stefanski, from the GM, Andrew Berry, all of it designed seemingly to defuse the blowback that was predictable. And there's one part that I just want to quote for you here from the owners of the team, Jimmy and Dee Haslam, who said this, quote, "Our team's comprehensive evaluation process was of utmost importance due to the sensitive nature of the situation and the complex factors involved," end quote. And what do you make of that particular position on this?
I don't think it means anything. I say that, you know, as someone who has seen this sort of exact statement put out many times from teams after making controversial signings. And, you know, these teams will often say, well, we really looked into it. We did our own investigation. It was comprehensive, but they rarely give details about what that entailed. I mean, in this case, the statement from the Browns references, you know, spending a lot of time interviewing Deshaun Watson, which frankly does not sound like a comprehensive investigation to me. Tony Busby, the lawyer who represented the women, has already come out and said none of the teams asked to interview the complainants. And I think that really says it all.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, Mina, this was an overwhelming week in the most popular sport in our country, and I actually still want to get to everything else that happened with you after the break.
Let's do it.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Okay, so now we're sort of in the football part of this podcast. And Mina, I want to ask about just what Deshaun Watson means as a hypothetical top five quarterback to the Cleveland Browns in the 2022 season in particular. What kind of an impact can he have on the field?
Well, your question, the phrasing, the 2022 season in particular is really important, right? Because again, we don't know how much football Deshaun Watson is going to play in 2022. So, you know, I can look at this roster and I can say it's excellent. The Lions are good. The defense really improved a lot. I think they felt quarterback play was clearly a limiting factor for them. And if you were to tell me Deshaun Watson is playing tomorrow, well, then they're an instant Super Bowl contender in my estimation, just given the last time I saw him playing. But again, we don't know if he's actually going to play.
And the other data point in all of this, as the Cleveland Browns depth chart is concerned, is that
yes,
Baker Mayfield is still on it. And like the last thing we heard from Baker, I mean, that was its own soap opera. It was the fact that he had tweeted screenshots from the Notes app of his iPhone, Mina, the official platform for TLDR professional announcements. And he said, quote, "This is not a message with hidden meaning," while thanking the city of Cleveland and its fan base. And then 2 days later, naturally, the meaning became, I would say, less hidden.
Yes.
Because he demands a trade via Adam Schefter. And then Deshaun Watson takes his job. And so what does all of this mean for Baker?
Notably, he put out that post amidst the reporting that, as you said, you know, the Browns were pursuing Watson. I think it's kind of to some, I mean, people can argue about how he handled it, but I think it's understandable that he had some dissatisfaction. It got very messy very quickly, mm-hmm. especially, by the way, after it was reported that the Browns were out of the running. And yeah. You know, then we heard, well, they're not going to honor Baker's trade request now. But then they did the deal and suddenly they are going to trade him, most likely. I mean,
yeah, Mina, the whole like problematic rose ceremony metaphor of all of this, it's one thing to do that. And another thing to also have like your former number one overall pick in 2018 just also standing there.
Yeah, it's a lot of awkward hedging and, you know, pursuing someone by trying to hold on to someone else. And it's a reminder, by the way, that, you know, football teams aren't managed like spreadsheets. These are human beings. And where we landed is that, you know, it is likely that Baker Mayfield will be traded. The Browns notably signed Jacoby Brissett as a backup, although, again, I think that suggests they're anticipating suspension, quite frankly. Mm. So the question is, where will Baker Mayfield go and what will they get for him? And I think that's a really complicated question. There are still several football teams that need quarterbacks. He reportedly wants to go to Indianapolis, who traded away Carson Wentz. Makes sense. Very desirable team. But there are other quarterbacks that could be in the mix for this weird game of musical chairs. Jimmy Garoppolo is likely to be traded by San Francisco. And then Matt Ryan, you know, his team aggressively pursued Deshaun Watson and actually pushed back his roster bonus as they did so. He agreed to it. So I think, you know, he handles things very differently from Baker Mayfield. But I think a lot of people wouldn't blame him for wanting to be traded after the way Atlanta, which is the team where he spent his entire career, you know, at MVP season, how they've treated him in all of this.
Okay, so I'm looking at my list now. I'm assembling this of Baker Mayfield destinations. And I'm looking at Indy, his choice, San Francisco, Atlanta. Who else is in the mix here? Because clearly, like, there are a bunch of teams that have quarterback questions still.
Well, I think it seems like San Francisco is probably going to roll with Trey Lance, who is their, you know, top draft pick last year. But there are other teams that have very, very open holes at the quarterback position. You know, you mentioned Atlanta, if Matt Ryan is traded. Carolina, which has been desperate to find a quarterback. I think people seem to forget that they've just traded a pretty significant draft pick for Sam Darnold. Obviously, that didn't work out. New Orleans has been linked to Jameis Winston coming back, but we'll see what happens there. Seattle, currently the top quarterback on their roster is Drew Lock. One would think they might be interested in an upgrade.
Hold on. On Seattle, like, do you see that being a fit? And also, like, where are you in the stages of grief around Russell Wilson?
I've been outspoken. I don't think they got a good return for him. I think, by the way, some of these contracts, including Watson's contract and the Matt Stafford contract that just came out, and, you know, all these quarterbacks getting over $40 million a year as Russell Wilson nears the end of his current contract, I can see the argument for Seattle not wanting to pay it. But quarterback is still, again, such a question mark for them that it's hard to even evaluate where they are in the rebuilding process.
Yeah. It sounds like you're in the rational, level-headed, like you're past copium in the stages of grief. Are you? It sounds like you're better.
Yeah. What is that? Stage 9 or something? Yeah. I don't know. Yes. Thank you. I do feel like I'm being more rational these days.
But look, another rational move, seemingly, that was made that you just alluded to is this Matt Stafford thing with the Rams, another NFC West team you know really well, because that $160 million extension that he got over 4 years, what did that suggest to you on Los Angeles' part?
You know, so not terribly surprising, and the financial cost is about similar to the Dak Prescott contract. You know, now there's about, I guess, 5 or 6 quarterbacks making over $40 million. That's sort of, you know, the price tag goes up every year. But what it tells you is not only that the Rams have confidence in Matthew Stafford after he had, you know, career season, won a Super Bowl, which isn't surprising, but that they want to continue competing. And the thing about these kinds of contracts is from the outside, you look at them and say, well, won't it make it harder for them to build their roster or keep the band together if they're giving a quarterback this much money? And the truth is that's actually not the case, because if you give a quarterback a mega contract with a mega signing bonus, it basically means you can push the cost down the road. So what happens, you know, when contracts are restructured, salaries reduced, signing bonuses can get spread over many years. And I think the Rams clearly, you know, they want to bring talent back. There's whispers of them wanting to do a deal with Aaron Donald. They signed Allen Robinson. They might try to bring back OBJ. And for me, this is just another piece of evidence that they continue to be all in.
It does also feel like the Rams winning the Super Bowl, that might have emboldened all sorts of other all-in behavioral case studies across the NFL, Mina, because I mean, if it wasn't for Deshaun Watson, like for the record here, we probably would be spotlighting what is happening in Vegas appropriately, given the all-in-ness of this, because they just traded for Davante Adams, the wide receiver from Green Bay, obviously Aaron Rodgers' human binky, and they made him the highest paid non-quarterback of all time. So how should Packers fans first feel about this?
Well, from the Packers side, you can kind of see both sides of it. It hurts. Like, we're talking about a guy who's arguably the best wide receiver in the NFL. His connection with Aaron Rodgers is incredible. He has been the centerpiece of that offense for quite some time now. But, you know, this is another team where they had some salary cap issues. And I think while they reportedly, you know, were actually willing to give Adams the same contract or even more money, and he walked away from it, I think the outcome is they now have some financial flexibility to retain some of their other players. And they've done that. They brought back tight end Robert Tonyan on a 1-year deal. Devondre Campbell is their superstar linebacker last year. Rasul Douglas. So I think you can look at this as a Packers fan and say it hurts, but I understand that, you know, it allows them to build a more complete roster. Now, that said, Pablo, they really need wide receivers. Luckily, they now have a couple of first-round picks because of the trade, and I would not be surprised if they use at least one of them on one of the marquee wide receivers in the draft.
So on the Aaron Rodgers end of this equation, though, is this the sort of thing where, like, this isn't what he signed up for, or is your understanding that actually he understands what is happening here through the financial math that you just described?
It's been reported that he knew about it or knew that Adams was likely to leave. And I find that pretty believable, honestly, mostly because he hasn't put out any emo social media posts. So
I do like how one of them at least took that Last Dance meme on Instagram seriously.
Listen, yeah, it really turned out to be true. Didn't end the way it did with the Bulls, but Rodgers did take, you know, a mega extension.
Yes.
And I think, you know, while again, as I alluded to with Matt Stafford, these mega extensions can actually increase financial flexibility for some teams. I think he saw the writing on the wall.
Okay. So the Raiders, like, what is the writing on their wall saying right now?
We're in a hellscape of a division and we got to do whatever it takes to compete. I mean, the AFC West is loaded. Of course, Russell Wilson with Denver now, Kansas City, perennial Super Bowl contenders, and the Chargers, who I'm going to get to in a moment. really, really got locked and loaded this offseason. And this is not the kind of move you make if you don't think you can compete in the short term. Because not only did they make Davante Adams, you know, the highest paid non-quarterback, they also sent away their first and second round draft picks. They are clearly very invested in making this offense as explosive as the other offenses in their division. Whether it'll work, I don't know. But this is a move that's pretty transparent.
But in terms of looking around at this division, I mean, they look at Kansas City and they have Patrick Mahomes. They look at the Broncos and they have Russell Wilson. They look at the Chargers and they have Justin Herbert. And now, like, yeah, a whole arsenal that they're building around him, right? Like, this is the degree of difficulty is absurd.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying, frankly. I can't remember the last time I thought a division was this stacked purely because of what these teams can do on offense. Now, I think arguably on defense, you know, that's where it gets a little bit dicier with some of the rosters. But on offense, I don't think you can compete in the AFC West unless you have a top 10 unit.
So the Raiders, they also signed Chandler Jones to help deal with all of those quarterbacks, the star defensive end. That's a big deal. The other big edge rusher of the offseason, though, Von Miller, he goes to Buffalo, to the decidedly more peaceable AFC East. What does that move signal to you about what the Bills are doing?
I feel like I've used the phrase all in like 10 times already.
Same.
On this podcast. But
yeah, we need synonyms. Yeah.
They're all in. I can you help me think of a better synonym? Invested?
They are pot committed.
Down.
I keep on going to like bad poker metaphors. Yeah.
Yeah, ironically, when the Rams did the trade for Stafford and signed OBJ and Von Miller, people talked about them being all in, and they posted the gif of the guy in Rounders pushing his chips to the middle of the table, which, if you've seen the movie, does not work out.
No.
But it did work out for them. It worked out for them. gif does lie sometimes, I guess. But yeah, I think the Bills rightfully view themselves as Super Bowl contenders. They were like 13 seconds away from beating the Chiefs and getting to the conference championship. And they looked at this as an opportunity to upgrade a pass rush that, you know, was losing some pieces. Miller signed to a 6-year, $120 million deal. Of course, that is not a real deal. I believe he's getting about a little over 50 million of that is guaranteed. I think 45 million fully guaranteed, but you know, it's still a significant amount of money for a guy who's about to turn 33, who's also a guy who is fantastic for the Rams down the stretch, lead on their Super Bowl run. And I think the Bills saw that and they thought, we have the quarterback, we have all these pieces, let's add the final piece and see if it works out.
So as free agency then is like finally coming to a close and all of these teams are, I don't know, like crossing the Rubicon, like casting the dot. I'm going like Roman Empire metaphors in an attempt to get synonyms here, which is just like embarrassing. But as all of these teams are doing this, who won, Mina, out of everyone?
The football hipster thing to do is to point to like marginal moves. Like I could say, the Ravens signing Morgan Moses to play right tackle was a great sign. I thought it was a great signing. I loved it.
I'm imagining like a frayed Morgan Moses t-shirt that you're wearing in like Bowery Ballroom now.
The other one, the Bills actually signed Tim Settle as a defensive tackle from Washington. And that's another move that a lot of people love for the value and sort of, you know, quietly under the radar players. Typically, teams that spend a lot of money in free agency don't win. It doesn't work out. That said, I absolutely love what the Chargers did this offseason. And they spent a lot of money. They had a lot of money. And they acquired J.C. Jackson, a star cornerback from the Patriots, on a pretty reasonable contract, actually. They traded for Khalil Mack from Chicago. They signed Sebastian Joseph Day. They kept Mike Williams. Just a bunch of big moves. And the reason I love it, Pablo, is because they have the most valuable thing in football, which is a star quarterback, Justin Herbert, playing on a rookie contract. Mm. And I think going, oh no, I'm about to say it again, all in, you have a quarterback who doesn't cost a lot of money, is an astute use of resources.
Mina, I am shocked that you did not go all in on Denver as the answer to who won free agency.
I got to bring up old news. That was like 2 weeks ago. We're moving on.
Yeah, I don't want to drag you back to stage 8 at this point. But coming up, there is one Seattle sports legend that I'm pretty sure you do want to talk about.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com. Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Mina, it's also very important for us to acknowledge here that the sport you cover, the sport you love, also lost one of its original insiders, one of the most important people who ever covered the game over the weekend, because John Clayton died. And John Clayton, who was nicknamed the Professor, may be the guy that most people, my generation at least, may remember from the greatest This Is SportsCenter commercial of all time.
Truly.
And it's also worth pointing out that the man lived in Seattle, the place where you yourself have really deep roots. And so I'm curious, as someone who grew up watching the league that he covered for decades, did you have any memories of the man that you wanted to share?
Yeah, you know, like a lot of Seattle sports fans, especially Seahawks fans, I grew up reading, listening to, consuming everything John Clayton did. I looked up to him a lot. And then ultimately, when I became, a sports reporter, I looked up to him not just as someone I listened to, but someone I wanted to be like. I admired so much the way he covered the league, the professionalism, the passion. I mean, the love he had for Seattle sports, it was infectious. And ultimately, when I came to ESPN, I got the opportunity to meet him a couple times. And one of the things we talked about was how much we both loved Kenny Easley, who was a safety for the Seahawks in the 80s. Just incredibly hard-hitting, incredible, one of the best safeties of all time, I believe. And so John Clayton, he was a Hall of Fame voter. And I'll never forget, I was at the Super Bowl in Houston covering it for ESPN.com. And John and I had talked about how much we were hoping Easley would get into the Hall of Fame, and it wasn't a sure thing. And I just remember him coming out of voting and looking for me. He found me, and he told me. First, he winked at me. I remember this. And he said, "I think he's in." And we both kind of had to, like, suppress, I don't know how happy we are, that the homerism aspect of it, but it meant a lot to me that he even remembered that, that he knew to seek me out. And I think just, I was struck, as I so often was, by his kindness to a reporter. He really, a younger reporter, he just really didn't know that well. And I think what you're seeing across NFL media, especially Seattle, but everywhere, is stories that are pretty similar. Stories about how kind he was, how generous he was with his time, and how much he loved covering the sport. And that's something I think a lot of us who do that aspire to, and he set a bar that's very hard to reach.
Mina Kimes, thank you for joining us, as always.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.